Today's Teisho will be on Case 30 in the Mumonkan, The Gate of No Barrier. Case 30 is titled Basso, Basso's This Very Mind is Buddha. Daibai asked Basso, "What is Buddha?" Basso answered, "This very mind is Buddha." Mumon's comment, "If you can directly grasp Basso's meaning, you will wear the Buddha's clothes, eat the Buddha's food, speak the Buddha's words, do the Buddha's deeds, that is, you are the Buddha himself." However, alas, Daibai misled not a few people into taking the mark on the scale for the weight itself. How could he realize that even mentioning the word Buddha should make us rinse out our mouths for 3 days? If a person of understanding hears anyone say, "This very mind is Buddha," he will cover his ears and rush away. Muon's verse, "The blue sky and the bright day, no more searching around. What is the Buddha?" you ask. With loot in your pocket, you declare yourself innocent. So that's case 30. And then, today is two for the price of one. Because we're going to do also case 33. This is Basso. Basso is Matsu, ancestor horse, Matsu. Great Zen teacher. Really, so much of Zen comes out of Matsu. Everybody, Linji, Zhaozhou, Joshu, all of them are like the children of ancestor horse, Matsu. So this is, the first one was, the Japanese say Basso. Basso's This Very Mind is Buddha. And this one is Basso's No Mind, No Buddha. A monk asked Basso, "What is the Buddha?" Basso answered, "No mind, no Buddha." Mumon's comment, "If you understand this, you have finished studying Zen." Mumon's verse, "Present a sword if you meet a swordsman. Don't offer a poem unless you meet a poet. When talking, tell one third of it. Don't divulge the whole at once." So, in case 30, a monk, Daibai asked Basso, "What is the Buddha?" And Basso said, "This very mind." In case 33, a monk asked Basso, "What is the Buddha?" Basso said, "No mind, no Buddha." So, what's this all about, anyway? We all have, I hope you meditate often. We all have really busy lives, really busy. But, it's so important to get on the cushion, try to get on the cushion as often as you possibly can, ideally every day, and enter into Mushin. And then, even if it's a half an hour, get off the cushion and go out into the world, and it's a different place. It's so difficult to live, in my opinion, without practice. And if you practice regularly, it makes a huge difference in how you go through the day. I'm sure you've experienced that yourself. And when we meditate, we definitely have moments where we ground ourselves in a deep, imperturbable calm, So recently there was a crisis in my office, it was a serious issue, not something that we were really responsible for, but something we had to deal with, and that was really unforeseen. And it's definitely the case that when things like that happen, you wake up in the middle of the night and you can't get back to sleep, you're thinking about the problem you need to solve. And if this goes on for a while, it's like a burning wheel. You know, the Buddha talked about existence. Early Buddha talked about existence as a wheel. And in early Buddhism, the emblem for existence in the world of form was this wheel, burning wheel. And we've all been on the burning wheel. You know, it's a terrible place to be, right? You know, you get up in the morning and you realize you've got to deal with this problem, and maybe as you go through the day, it actually escalates, right? It actually gets more serious, or there are more angles that you have to work through. And even if that's not happening to you right now, you know, the world we live in is a burning wheel. You know, my wife, Barbara, and I were talking, we were having a cup of coffee in the morning, and she said, you know, I think I'm getting a little depressed. And that's odd, because my wife has a pretty good, she seems to be pretty upbeat about most things. And she said, you know, I think I'm getting really depressed. I'm going to have to go on a news diet. Because, you know, reading about Donald Trump every day is getting me depressed. You know, I feel powerless, and all of these bad things are happening. And I think I mentioned this last time, that Trump had signed some regulation that lets more dumping of chemical waste into the streams. It's almost like, you know, if you said, what would be the worst thing he could do, he would do it, you know. And, you know, apparently they have just, I think that was sort of like the last straw for her, you know, basically that he was undoing the Clean Water Act. And as somebody who loves nature, she found that sort of heartbreaking. So, you know, it's definitely the case that the world can be like a burning wheel. The Buddha had a very famous sermon, very famous, like, sutra. It's actually called in English, it's a fire sermon, the fire sermon. But it's a sutra where he says, monks and nuns, this world is burning. And he says, it's burning in your eye, it's burning in your ear, it's burning, you know, every sensation is giving you information that is on fire, that causes you these powerful emotional responses. You know, very, very... you know, it's easy to think about the Buddhist time as like this peaceful time when everybody loved each other, but it wasn't like that at all. You know, the Buddha, I've mentioned on many occasions, you know, the Buddha's family, his tribe or his clan group were totally annihilated in a genocide. So, and all his life he was involved in, he couldn't escape being involved in the events of his time. So he was definitely invited to meet kings and magistrates. He would go to cities where the mayor would greet him. People would come to him with his problem, with their problems. You know, so the Buddha was really in the thick of it. You know, people also think of the Buddha as living in a forest and just peacefully meditating. And indeed, he got up every day and he meditated. Long after his great awakening experience, the Buddha meditated every day. And he would go out and beg for his food just like every other monk and nun. Nothing special. Right? So the Buddha was a remarkable person in that regard. Right? You know, he would go out and beg just like everybody else. No special treatment, you know. People knew who he was, of course, and people revered him. But, you know, the Buddha had to deal with a lot of trouble, a lot of problems in his own time. You know, some of his best students were assassinated, were murdered. People don't realize that either, but, you know, not everybody liked the Dharma. You know, there were, you know, just as Gandhi was shot, you know, some of the Buddha's key teachers were murdered. And the Buddha's own cousin tried to kill him several times. Right. So, you know, the Buddha had knew what he was talking about when he was talking about the burning wheel. And we're all on the burning wheel sometime. It can be, you know, the whole country is in this place that's not a good place. You know, if you care about the environment, you probably feel at times that you're on the burning wheel. And, it, you know, in your own personal life, you may be on the burning wheel. You know, having a work situation that's difficult and unpleasant is really horrible. You know, I myself have had to work for people who are really not nice people, you know, and watching your superiors, you know, bully other people and maybe keep other people in a state of constant anxiety is a horrible place to be. That's the burning wheel. It's like, let me out of here. Let me off of this burning wheel. You know, we've all been there, you know. There are other forms of the burning wheel too, illness, right? I mean, nobody wants to get a diagnosis of cancer, right? That is definitely not something any... And when it happens, you think, oh my God, you know, get me off this... And you know, cancer is... It's not just the disease. The cure is as bad as the disease. You know, you have to go in and be irradiated, or you take chemotherapy, and you can't get out of bed, and your hair falls out, and you know, it's a burning wheel every day. So there's definitely a very powerful teaching of the Buddha's. You know, this the fire sermon. The world is burning. Your eye is burning, your ear is burning. You know, we've all been there. And it's really wonderful, right? If you can just make the time in the middle of your burning world to sit down and carve out like half an hour, 45 minutes, or even an hour. And you know, you go through this process, right? Where you sit down on the cushion and you know, you try to watch the breath, and maybe you have a few minutes of peace, and then all of it comes back, right? There's your boss, you know, but if you've trained yourself well, if you do this fairly regularly, you know, you won't stay in that place where you keep rehearsing the events that are causing you anxiety and that are triggering your fear or your anger or whatever. You know, if you've practiced, you know, you train yourself well, you sit down on the cushion, you watch the breath, you begin to enter samadhi, and then this stuff starts coming up. But if you can get into emptiness, you're grounding yourself in that imperturbable place. And you keep going back there as new anxieties arise, or these things are popping up on the screen of your mind that trigger these responses. You keep going back to Mushin. So, you know, there's your boss, and then back to Mushin, and there's your boss, and back to Mushin, and there's your boss, and back to Mushin. And pretty soon, you know, the boss stops appearing on the screen of your mind. Or when the boss appears, it's no longer triggering anxiety or anger, right? It's just your boss, just his face. And this process is so important. You know, if you don't practice meditation, you know, it's you're like blown about by the wind all the time. Any event can trigger like this hurricane of emotional responses, and you're helpless to deal with that. You know, people do try to deal with that. You know, they drink, or they take drugs, or they develop other kinds of addictions. You know, there are lots of people who are gambling addicts. You know, even the great Russian writer Dostoevsky was actually a gambling addict. You know, and when he would be overcome with anxiety, he would go play cards, and he racked up this huge gambling debt, and the debt. But the terror of debt would distract him from the other terrors in his life, and so actually being afraid was more he preferred those fears to other fears in his life, which actually involved like his getting killed and things. So Dostoevsky picked a bad strategy for dealing with this anxiety. Alcohol is another bad strategy, I would say. But, you know, we're just blown about by the wind until we can get to that imperturbable calm. And if you, I'm sure everybody in this room has been there. It doesn't happen every time. But sometimes you sit down on the cushion, you watch your breath, and you just get into this empty place, and you can feel the anxiety draining away. It's just, you know, if you've done this a number of times, it's easy to take it for granted. But it's something not one in a thousand people can do that, you know. And people are mostly like hungry ghosts running from this bush to that bush, trying to get away from their fears and their anger and so on. To be able to sit down on the cushion and get to deep samadhi and experience that, there's an imperturbable calm if you just keep practicing. And that is so wonderful. So many times in my life, I have been on the burning wheel and I carve out that time to sit. And it's just, it's like, the more you do it, the more powerful it becomes. You know, it's like, you get to that place, it's totally calm. And when you get off the cushion, sometimes you're even laughing. It's just, it's like night and day. And so, you know, it's possible to get there with great, you know, to be honest with you, I've been doing this for 40 years. I can get there every time. But at first, it's very much hit or miss. But if you've been doing koan training and you've been working through your obstacles, you know, you can get there with great regularity. So this is definitely an important part of practice. And it's really what you could say it's really what Matsu, what Basso is talking about. When Daibai asks him, what is Buddha? Basso says, this very mind is Buddha. See, so, you know, we live in a world on fire, and we sit down on the cushion, and no matter where we go, we are not going to find that peace, in my opinion, and in Buddhist teaching, until we can enter deep mushin and find that imperturbable calm. You know, you can be on a vacation, and if you have something bothering you at work, it'll haunt you. You're on the beach, it's a beautiful day, and you're on the beach with your family, but who do you see in your head? You see your boss. You know, that you can't get away from your boss even on the beach, right? You know? So being able to ground yourself in that emptiness, and you, in about 10 minutes, if you're practiced, 10 or 15 minutes, you can feel the anxiety drain away, and you're in a neutral place. And then you just keep going back to that emptiness as these stressors arise, and eventually you're washed clean of your problems, at least at that time. You get off the cushion, and it's like everything is fresh and alive, right? So beautiful. You know, maybe before you sat down on the cushion, you were thinking, you know, I can't believe this is happening to me. You know, life is really crap. You know, you sit down on the cushion. Maybe you come on a Saturday and you do the whole Saturday. You leave here and you look outside and you think, oh, how lucky I am to be alive. How beautiful all this is. You know, this is a regular part of practice. This is like house cleaning. You know, you need to clean your house, and this is part of your practice. You know. And I would urge we're all busy, but you know, nobody, I've never had anybody come to work and say, you know, I just didn't have a chance to, I'm still in my pajamas, you know, I didn't have a chance to take a shower and brush my teeth. You know, hygiene is what we expect of ourselves, right? And you can make meditation part of your mental hygiene. But you know, there's a problem with this too, actually. You know, if you learn how to do this and get into deep samadhi, that wonderful calm is so liberating that you might actually think it's liberation. But it's not. It's not liberation. It's a moment of liberation, but it's not, you could say, complete liberation. So you know, when the Buddha left his family, And he went to study. He went to study with two of the most advanced meditation teachers of his time. One was Udraka Ramaputra, and the other was a man named Alara Kalama. And in different ways, both of them taught him how to enter emptiness and find this imperturbable calm. And actually, the Buddha, according to the early sutras, you know, the Pali Sutras, they were so impressed by the Buddha's ability to do this that they taught separately, and he studied with Alara first and then Udraka. But basically, they were so impressed. Each of them said, "Listen, you know, I will make you my heir. You will be the next in my lineage if you stay here." And the Buddha, you know, he couldn't stay. He respected them, but he felt this isn't complete enlightenment. You know, if you can't find that place, that stable place where you're grounded and your mind becomes blank, you are like the Mumonkan, Master Mumon says, you're like a hungry ghost running through the dead trees, right? That's being on the burning wheel. Beautiful. Hungry ghost. Hungry ghost is a dead person who doesn't know he's dead. And he has all the appetites of a living person, but can't satisfy them because he no longer has a body. And he experiences his desires as deformities in his body. So, you know, if you're a hungry ghost, you feel that you have a tiny little mouth, and you're looking at everybody eating cake at the party, but you can't eat the cake because you have a tiny little mouth. This is a Buddhist mythology. But we've all been hungry ghosts sometimes. We've all been unable, I'm sure you've had experiences like that. If something's really bothering you, if somebody's done you an injury, and you go to a party, you can't even hear what people are saying, right? You know, you're so focused on the event that the cake is tasteless, you know? I'm sure you've been there. So now you're in your hungry ghost state, right? Hungry ghost state. And you can look around for something. Maybe I'll go to the refrigerator and I'll eat something sweet and it'll take my anxiety away. But that doesn't work, right? So that's a hungry ghost mode. So being able to ground yourself in that emptiness is absolutely a great accomplishment. It takes a lot of practice to get there, and it takes a lot of practice to get there with regularity. And if you stop practicing, you will stop going there. You know, if you stop meditating, you won't be a bad person, but you'll definitely lose the ability to do this. You know, so it's important to keep practicing. But that's not everything, right? The Buddha went to Alara Kalama, he went to Udraka Ramaputra, they taught him how to enter emptiness, he got into this very beautiful, peaceful state, and he said, "This is wonderful," and they said, "Exactly, liberation." And the Buddha said, "That is not liberation, because, you know, as soon as I get off the cushion, I still feel separate from the world around me." You know, and if you're not careful, cultivating that imperturbable mind of deep samadhi can be almost like a drug in itself. You know, so I think most people in the United States who practice mindfulness, so-called, are really getting into this state. They're calmer, they're grounded, but I think it's a very artificial place to be. If you stop your practice there, you're only half the way, and actually you can become a worse person. You know, you begin to crave the sweetness of samadhi. You begin to crave the peace, that peace of deep mushin. So when you're in a hellish situation, you say, "Oh, you know, I want to be in that place where there's nothing. Just nothing. Ah, peace," right? But what that does is make your situation worse, not better. You begin to discriminate between peaceful moments and moments that aren't peaceful, and you develop a craving or preference for the peaceful moment. And many people think of meditation as this, right? So, you know, the world is full of commercial products that sell zen-y things, right? And you can get some zen wind chimes for your backyard, and you listen to the wind chimes, you feel the peace, right? You know, or, you know, there's countless different things like this. You know, zen is supposed to be peaceful and quiet. You know, so people who practice zen are supposed to prefer the deep, dark forest where there's no sound, no noise, no... Well, that's a fantasy. That's a fantasy, and it's a misunderstanding of the practice. You know, if Buddhism was about running away from the world and finding a peaceful spot, it would have vanished long ago. Now, it's true, there were great Zen teachers like Master Xu Yun, Empty Cloud, who lived for years out in nature. But if you study his life, you see what his life in nature was like. You know, Xu Yun stayed in the mountains in a hut, which is still there. It's still there. A man named Red Pine, an American Buddhist named Red Pine, went there and found the hut. No central heating. You know, no. I mean, Xu Yun stayed in that little hut in the middle of the winter, when it was 0 degrees, right? He had his robe, you know, and, you know, basically very challenging situation. You know, I would say Xu Yun didn't go out to live in nature to escape, but to challenge himself in very complicated ways. It's not easy being alone for long periods of time, unless you've cultivated deep awareness, and unless you've made it through many of your obstacles, that kind of solitude could produce mental illness, actually. You know, so people who are alone for long periods of time, if they're not exceptionally well prepared, develop all kinds of mental problems, you know. So I don't think Xu Yun was running away from anything. I think he was perfecting his concentration by giving himself really formidable obstacles. And when he would come back, you know, nothing bothered him. You know, if you've been sitting for days in, you know, basically 0 degree weather in a thin robe, you know, whether the towels are fresh or not is not going to cause you any anxiety, you know. So, yes, there is a tradition in Zen of people going out and practicing on their own, but it's not in order to find peace. So yes, we need peace. We need to get to deep samadhi. You need to get to that imperturbable place. But, you know, there was a Japanese master called Hasegawa. Hasegawa Roshi used to call that the cave of poison grass. So if you crave the sweetness of peace, the peaceful stillness, you begin to run away from things in your life instead of facing them. You know, you begin to crave that peacefulness, that stillness, and that's a perversion of the path. You know, that's not what Zen is about. Zen is about always being at peace no matter where you are, on a busy street, on the burning wheel. See, we're not getting off the burning wheel. We're on the burning wheel, but we're imperturbable. This is like being a lotus in the fire. To be a lotus in the water, nice. Be a lotus in the fire, that's why Xu Yun went up into the mountain, see. No matter what he encountered, he could work it through. So there's this other koan. A monk asked Basso, "What is the Buddha?" Basso answered, "No mind, no Buddha." See, so part one, you could say, of Zen practice is learning how to enter deep samadhi, right? And this is a crucial path. You know, this is why we all do. When Master Mumon created the Mumon Kan, which is really like a teaching book for monks and nuns, he starts with Mu, and then we go on to the other koans. But actually, you know, that's because mu, that emptiness, that grounded imperturbability, is the foundation of all subsequent practice. If you don't know how to get there, you can't really work with koans. So, you know, koans, for people who can't get to that place, are really harmless diversions, but they don't really produce transformation. So Mumon understood this and put the mu koan first of all, and why it's why in our tradition too we do mu first, okay. But you know, after mu, you know, your teacher is supposed to give you koans, a new koan. And the new koans are not supposed to create peace and stillness. You know, koans are supposed to challenge you. You know, so you know, a good teacher won't let you stay in the cave of poison grass. You have to be able to get there. You have to be able to ground yourself. But then a good teacher is not going to let you stay too long in that still place. You have to be able to confront life, you know, head on, full on, in all its challenges. The problem, though, is that we come to our experiences in life with all this baggage, right? We bring to events all of this, you could say, karmic baggage that prevents us from responding to them creatively. So, you know, the first time I ever the first time I ever gave an academic talk was so difficult. You know, I remember getting up on the podium, and about first couple of minutes I was giving this paper that I had rehearsed and rehearsed. I had in my line of work, professors go to conferences and they give papers. And I was giving a paper at a conference, and I had practiced the paper. Sometimes in the sciences, people just get up and talk, but in English and the humanities, we give like a formal presentation. You usually have like a little script, and you present, and I practiced and practiced. And when I got up to speak, I remember, you know, getting about 2 minutes in and thinking, this is going well. And then all of a sudden, like, this wave of anxiety came over me. And it was so paralyzing. You know, in my mind, my talk must have been just terrible. I think it was probably fine, if anybody was even paying attention. But in my mind, it was like every word was like crawling over broken glass, trying to get my sentences out, and I felt like I was just going to start crying at any minute, you know, just that stress. I talked to my graduate director, a wonderful man named Gary Cox, and he said, you know, you've got to give a paper right away, another one, and we found another conference, and I went to the conference, and you know, he was absolutely right. You know, I've given like many, many papers now, and it's, you know, I don't rehearse them. I just get up, and if I make a mistake, I make a mistake, right? You know, I remember years ago seeing this very famous professor give a talk, and he was talking about a writer named Thoreau, Henry David Thoreau. And in his talk, he said, Thoreau goes down to the pond and does this, this, and this. And then he gave his paper, and everybody clapped, and then they had a question and answer period. And somebody stuck up his hand and said, his name was Haworth, William Haworth. He said, Professor Haworth, you said Thoreau goes down to the river and to the pond and does this, this, and this, but he doesn't go down to the pond. And I was watching this, and I just thought, oh, that poor guy, he's going to burst into tears at any minute. But he didn't. He said, oh, you're right, now that I think about it. And he went on. It was like, okay, not a problem, right? I mean, he was able to deal with being wrong without all this baggage. you know, whatever it was about his life history, you know, he wasn't afraid to make a mistake in public. Maybe he'd made so many mistakes, it didn't bother him anymore, you know. But I was actually kind of like, obviously I haven't forgotten about this event, it was 30 years ago. But he was so cool and calm, and there was no shame in his response. He didn't go, "Oh my God, I'm so sorry. You know, what a terrible person I am. I've made this." He just said, "Oh yeah, you know, you're right now that I think about it. Thanks," he said, you know, and we went on. And I think that's somebody who's able to deal with the experience without all of this baggage getting in the way. Maybe he's worked through his baggage, and maybe he didn't have baggage. But, you know, for myself, you know, I was so afraid of making a mistake in public. Maybe that was my upbringing. Maybe my parents made me very embarrassed about mistakes I made. You know, you know, I've definitely given lots of papers, and now I'm a little bit more like William Haworth. If I make a mistake and somebody corrects me, I just say thanks. You know, okay, we all make mistakes. But it's taken me a lot of papers to get to that place. And you know, I think Zazen is like that too. You know, when we do koans, you know, the life of the Zen student is not a life of living in a forest and being at peace. That's not a liberating situation for anybody. You know, the liberation comes from encountering obstacle after obstacle after obstacle, and working through your obstacles. There's no other way to live in a bigger world. You know, in the early Pali Sutras, the early sutras were oral transmissions from the Buddha. And the Buddha didn't speak Pali, P-A-L-I. He spoke a language called Prakrit, which is like Sanskrit. It's a Sanskrit dialect. But there is no written Prakrit. So we don't have any direct record of the Buddha's own words, but the monks who studied with him remembered his discourses and would pass them on in Pali, this other language related to Sanskrit, from monk to monk for about 200 years, and then they wrote everything down. But in the mix are a lot of mythological elements. So in one of the Pali Sutras, there are these gods, right? The Indian people believed in many, many gods. And there was Sakra, Devanan Indra. There are other gods too who encounter the Buddha in the early sutras. But there's a number of gods who come to the Buddha, and they're all complaining. It's an interesting bunch of it's an interesting sutra, because these gods come in, and this one god says to the Buddha, he says, "You know, I know your path is liberating, but it's just so hard. You know, it's hard to get up every day. Even though I'm a god, it's hard for me to get up every day and sit on the cushion, and I have to work through my problems." And it's an interesting sutra, and the Buddha says, "Listen, you know, get a grip on yourself." He says, we do what is difficult. The Buddha, he says, "I and my followers do what is difficult to do." You know, that's our job in life, is to do what others don't do. Our job is to do what's difficult to do in life. See, I love that sutra. You know, he says, don't look for the easy road, you know. You know, we're training to handle the difficult things in life. That's why we're here, right? You know, that's why we're here. We're here to deal with the challenges. You know, to face the... Lots of people are paralyzed by their fear and their anxiety. Some people are mentally ill and they just can't deal with things at all. You know, people who practice the Great Way, you know, our job is to be in the world and do good things. And, you know, we all have our fears and our anxieties. We all have our karmic obstacles to work through. But, you know, the goal is to work through them and then help others work through them. That's what this is all about. That's why if the Buddha had just been gone with Udraka Ramaputra and gotten up every day and had his meal and gone back and had a peaceful life, you know, he wouldn't have been fulfilling his destiny as the Buddha. You know, the Buddha had to deal with the genocide. Before the genocide, the country that was going to invade the Buddha's country tried to go to war 3 different times, according to the sutras. So, on the first occasion where an army was preparing to attack the Buddha's homeland, the Shakya Republic, he actually went to the king of the invading country. It was Kosala, I should say. And he met the king of Kosala, who respected the Buddha greatly. And the Buddha said, why are you doing this? You know, all you're going to cause is suffering. And the king thought it over and said, okay, you're right, I'm going to call off my troops. And then the records say that there was all this internal politics. And people wanted to invade the Shakya Republic. And, the second time the king said, okay, we'll invade, and the Buddha went the second time and talked him out of it the third time. But the last time the Buddha was away, and he wasn't there to talk the king out of it. And this might sound like a myth, but I don't think it's a myth at all. You know, I grew up in the Vietnam era, and I definitely didn't want my country to attack Vietnam. I thought that was completely wrong, and I was very upset about this country attacking Iraq. You know, I thought that was completely immoral. So you know, things in the real world definitely happen that we can't control, and that happened to the Buddha too. But after his people were annihilated, he didn't stop. You know, he got up every day, he meditated. And he went out there to make a difference, you know. And he had his power, his samadhi power, his deep mu power to ground himself. And he had been working through his obstacles. You know, they didn't have koans, but they had, you know, basically life presents you with koans, right? Sometimes you're in a job you don't like, but you can't quit because people are dependent on your income. You know, that's a koan, right? Sometimes you have a child you love, but you don't know what to do for that child. You know, you love, you know, my sister, you know, she has an older son. He's been doing so well, and now it turns out he dropped acid. You know, it's like, what's that all about, right? My sister... You know, she was just blown away. It's like, what are you doing? You know. So I think maybe when he was a little older, it might be okay to experiment, but not while you're in, you know, like high school. Maybe not a good idea. And my sister's, you know, she has her own obstacles to work through. She feels like she's a failure as a parent, et cetera, et cetera. So you have a son you love, you've done all this stuff to help him, and he does something crazy. You know, he's your son. What are you going to do? You don't know what to do, but you love him, and you have to help. That's a koan, right? So life gives us koans, and we definitely need to cultivate samadhi mind. We need to get on the cushion, work through our anxiety, get to that calm place. But then the goal of all of this is to get off the cushion again and to deal with that koan, whatever koan life hands us. And the koans we work with in the Momonkan are specially designed to help us get at the things that we fear the most, that we're hiding from ourselves. You know, we get injured in life, and we tell ourselves stories, right? So, I remember in my high school, I was a total nerd, and I didn't go to the prom in my high school, right? And, you know, the reason I really, I can see now, the reason I didn't go, when anybody would ask me, are you going to the prom? I always used to go, that prom, come on. You know, that's for, you know, the masses. You know, I'm not going to go to the prom. But the real reason I didn't go to the prom is I don't think anybody would have gone with me. Or at least I didn't have the nerve to ask somebody, right? So I made up a little story that I was superior to all these people who were going to the prom. I was running away from the prom. If I had confronted the prom, I would have found somebody and said, would you like to go? And then, who knows, they probably would have said, yes, sure. They were probably waiting for somebody to ask. And then I could have worn my, you know, lime green tuxedo or something to the prom. But I ran away from that challenge. And I told myself a little lie, right? That I was superior to these people. I could see farther than they could. Right? And so I never had that wonderful experience. But you work with your koans, and you're working with some particular koan that has nothing to do with a prom. There isn't a prom koan. But you're sitting on the cushion when you realize one day, I've been running away from this kind of human encounter all my life. And I'm so impoverished by it. You know, in the time I have remaining, I'm definitely going to try to ask a few people to the prom in one way or the other. And if they reject me, I'll be okay. See? And if you've done enough koans, when you do have to invite somebody to the prom, you're going to be you'll be able to deal with it much better. So, Dai Bai asked Basso, what is the Buddha? Basso answered, this very mind is the Buddha. That's half of it. A monk asked Basso, what is the Buddha? Basso answered, no mind, no Buddha. It's like, get off that cushion now. You're in samadhi. You've worked through your obstacles. Get off the cushion and basically, there's a lot of... This world is in bad need of good people who will make an effort to make it a better place. And fortunately, we've been training to do just that. Mumon's comment, if you understand this, you have finished studying Zen. In other words, there's no end to studying Zen. And we're happy, Zen people are happy. There's always another challenge. The world can get, every time you work through a challenge, every time you get up the nerve to ask somebody to go to the prom, whether they say yes or no, you're living in a bigger world because you're not governed by your fears, right? And every time you do that, you live in a bigger world, on and on forever. There's no end to Zen practice. Because, basically, the world just gets bigger and bigger. Mumon's verse, present a sword if you meet a swordsman. Don't offer a poem unless you meet a poet. When talking, tell one-third of it. Don't divulge the whole at once.